I'm Katie Woodring, a fifth-year graduate student at Harvard University.
And I'm Ben Woodring, a sixth-year graduate student in English at Harvard.
And so by your last names, I can tell that you're married?
Yes, that's right.
And you are Shakespeare scholars?
Working on it, yes. In training.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 323, Lovers and Scholars. For this Valentine's Day week, I wanted to introduce to you Benjamin and Catherine Woodring, Shakespearean scholars and married partners who combine their loves of Shakespeare and each other through their work at Harvard University. They were nice enough to sit down with me recently to talk about their wonderful Shakespearean nexus.
I'm fascinated by the fact that you guys are Shakespeare scholars because I've only met them... when they're aged and wizened and Yoda-like. And here you guys are like Luke and Leia. They were married. No, they weren't married. They're brother and sister. That's creepy. Okay, anyway. But you guys are on the beginning of it. What started your interest in Shakespeare or your passion for Shakespeare?
Well, the first Shakespeare class I took at Bates College was taught by Sanford Friedman. He started our first class off with this insane story. He was essentially on a flight that was hijacked in the 70s with apparently a huge copy of Shakespeare from Harvard. He's a graduate student with his wife. And
right.
The plane landed in Uganda, and all these passengers are taken off and are sort of waiting to see what their fate's going to be. And they read each other Shakespeare plays from his book. His son sort of read it out loud to kind of keep people calm.
Oh,
and the UN sort of negotiated to let the Americans leave, and they had to leave some of the Israelis there. So they left their massive tome with this Israeli family that had, a little infant. And I guess as they were fleeing the country, they used the book as a protection for the baby. And lo and behold, when they're on the helicopter, they see this bullet lodged through the book, right in front of the baby. So this is one of the most dramatic stories I'd ever heard. Still can't believe it's true. And it's, to start off my, the first time I took a Shakespeare class. So every time I, every time I start moaning about the size of my, Riverside Shakespeare
right.
or the Norton that I'm lugging around,
right.
I'm like, well, this could be saving lives. I could be, fighting people with it if
wow.
I need to, or protecting infants.
That's
so
right. Shakespeare could save your life.
Exactly.
That's really
yeah.
awesome. Shakespeare hath charms to soothe the savage breast. Now, is that Shakespeare? I actually don't even know whether that's a Shakespeare quote or not. It just makes me sound pompous and important.
Verify that.
Yes.
Yeah. Get on that, grad students.
Wikipedia.
For me, Shakespeare was just sort of a good nexus of history and philosophy and literature all at the same time. It seemed like a way to kill several birds with one stone because there's just so much there and so rich that you could really, spend many years excavating it and really learning from it. So
that's cool. And did you come to Shakespeare did you ever perform it? Either one of you?
No, actually.
Mm-mm.
Really?
No, we rely on you for that.
Okay. Oh dear. But that's really. I never thought of coming to it from a That's an interesting angle from a historical angle. I mean, of course, it's true. Even if Shakespeare's history plays, quote unquote, are fictionalized and or in some ways. What stand-ins for political things that he wants to say in Elizabethan England that he can't get away with saying outright. And so then how did you guys meet?
Well, Ben was a year ahead of me in the program, mm-hmm. and I was applying and came out for Accepted Students Weekend, and he got to show me around and
I was assigned to show her around, and so I was charged with the task of trying to pitch the program to this promising undergraduate.
Now this is a family podcast. How much showing around did you do?
Harvard gave me a sort of fund to take her out and show her the school and talk to her about the program.
A few extra expenses and dinners and
hotel rooms.
We ended up I took her to a coffee shop in the square, and we ended up talking for hours about everything. She comes from a neuroscience background, so we talked about everything from the mind to literature, and it was really just a neat experience, and I think it worked because she ended up matriculating. So
again, family podcast, try to keep the dirty words out of the thing. Wait, so you came from a neuroscience background. How did that then was it just Ben's charms, evil Shakespearean charm?
I took a number of English classes and undergraduate, but I had a really wonderful advisor who is neuroscience, biological psychology at Bates, and I had a really difficult time deciding what I wanted to do. So I took about 2 years off after I finished, after I graduated, and I worked in a lab for a year, and I loved it. It was great, but that was when I realized how much I missed English, and I missed Shakespeare, and so I took an extension course where we read George Eliot and lots of major British writers too. I realized that I really wanted to go to school, and I wanted it to be for English. So
it was the moment when grew tired of drilling into a rat's brain. What is it? Gluing the cannula? Is that what it's called?
Again, family podcast. Stop gluing the cannula.
We decided there was going to be a certain layer of hell that we were all destined to get to in the afterworld, where there'll be rats listening to terrible music as we are under anesthesia. But
the scholars like Katie are actually very welcome into departments these days. English has moved from the new criticism, earlier in the last century to really embracing other disciplines and trying to understand, dimensions of literature from many different angles. So, she was sort of an appropriate choice for
that. That's interesting, the new criticism. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, the new criticism is now technically the old criticism. But that was essentially, this understanding where we don't necessarily need to have a deep historical context, but we take the the literary artifact as a thing in itself and sort of explore it for its own richness. And of course, that's still a very productive vein, and there are many scholars that still...
One of the courses that I taught a couple semesters ago is sort of still run in that vein. It's a poetry class and taught by Helen Vendler, who's a brilliant new critic. And it's one of the few courses where you're still forced to memorize a poem and get up in front of class, recite it, and then write on what you learn through the process of memorizing poetry and really thinking about it as a complete work of art. And it was a really neat experience and I'm sure as someone involved in thinking about Shakespeare as writing plays meant to be heard and performed and not read, that there's a really important, there are important considerations to think about how these are memorized recited. So
no, I think that's absolutely right. And I was wondering how that applies. Is that something you make your students do as well? Is performance an aspect of the critical process?
Right. So at Harvard specifically, they've launched an initiative in the last couple years of really reintegrating the creative and performance aspects of literary study. Yeah. So we've actually been promoting that. We are encouraged to include creative dimensions in the syllabus and that kind of thing. So every course that we've taught that Shakespeare related recently has had this option of doing a final project. We've had students do some very, very interesting presentations. They do, new adaptations of, Titus Andronicus done as a newscast or something like that. Some things work better than others, but it's neat to see students thinking about this, partially because undergraduates are so you know, involved in clubs and drama typically in the first place. Right. And they want to be able to recruit that dimension of their personality to use in an academic context because they see it as an important aspect of themselves.
I'm Michael Whitmore, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? We will return in March with performances of The Complete World of Sports Abridged in Scottsdale, Arizona and Moorhead, Minnesota. And then in April, we begin our 12-week tour of Great Britain with the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged Revised. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. Now, as grad students at Harvard, Ben and Katie Woodring work closely with Harvard professor and Shakespeare scholar Stephen Greenblatt, author of the New York Times bestselling Will in the World. I asked them what it's like to work for and with Professor Greenblatt.
Stephen is a terrific advisor, and you know, he is known for launching this new historicist take on studying literature. And there is where, you know, you look at a play as sort of another piece of an ongoing conversation, a complex conversation with many voices in a culture at any given time. So nothing is off limits in trying to sort of determine, you know, how meaning is made and produced in a society. Everything from plays to pamphlets to graffiti to journals and that kind of thing, which, you know, gives you a better understanding of the way that cultural meaning is not just about the great classics, but it's happening at the margins as well. And so, you know, that having a good training in both the new criticism and new historicism, I think, really allows one to kind of try to complete the whole picture.
Right. Well, and of course, Shakespeare wasn't classics in his day. Right. He was TV.
You know, right? Is that right?
I would say that's right. And of course, he doesn't come from the same sort of illustriously classically trained background. I mean, there's a long going debate about the extent of his Latin. He probably knew Latin well enough since he was teaching it at one point, but he didn't have the immense learning of someone like Johnson.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And but Johnson's plays don't live as long.
Yeah, and you know, at the end of the day, Shakespeare was a playwright looking, you know, motivated by success and getting people to come to the theater. We strive to please you every day. It's that, you know, it was one of the major motivations for what he was for their, you know, his art.
He was putting butts in seats.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right. And if it wasn't going to entertain, you know, the popular crowd coming over and crossing over the river, then it you know, wasn't gonna sell. He wasn't gonna have a living. And
Well, and one of the things that's interesting to me is that many of his jokes don't travel. So you know, that's why our line is, you know, Shakespeare's tragedies are much funnier than his comedies, because his comedies have a lot of local references or in jokes of the day. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like Shakespeare's audiences were much more, not well-read, not much more well-read, but incredibly well-read. So his literary allusions, his historical allusions were not lost on his audience, because his audience, from the royals to the groundlings, understood what he was talking about. Does that is that in some way kind of what you're talking about, an evidence of his educated audience?
So I think that, you know, there's one of the neat things about the theater going population at that time is it's so diverse. So you have, you know, people who are, you know, the penny seats who you know, some of these things may go over their heads, some of these references. So you see, part of the diversity in Shakespeare's texts themselves are this, you know, these complex concessions to different audiences. So, you know, in something like the Comedy of Errors, you still have, you know, sort of just very basic tomfoolery. People getting bopped on the nose. But then you have, you know, of course, all of these moments more arcane references and sort of, you know, complex, evocative, and sophisticated moments that may be for a more sort of refined
clientele. Right, a little something for everybody.
Right. Yeah.
And moments of just, you know, in sort of the Shakespearean fashion, just startling beauty of the lyric that you have in even a play like The Comedy of Errors, where that's, I think actually the comedy translates pretty well and for today's audience.
Just, well, listen, any 20-something lady who can reference the Three Stooges has a fine appreciation of comedy already.
And I was also going to add that even though the comedies are a little, you know, more difficult to translate over time, comparatively, Shakespeare is much less topical and localized than a lot of the other playwrights of the time. So, though it's, you know, compared with his highly exportable tragedies, his comedies are still the most exportable compared to others at the time, because Ben Jonson is just absolutely saturated.
Yeah.
Right.
It's important to remember, even back in Shakespeare's time, that there was a lot of flexibility in terms of you know, how one wanted to present a play, even from one performance to the next. To go back to Comedy of Errors, you know, which was performed at the Inns of Court, you know, so much work is done from the scholarly angle on trying to get it right in terms of, well, how was the playhouse set up at the Inns of Court when they did a play?
Right.
Well, it turns out, we're finding out more and more, this was highly variable. That, you know, it turns out that for this one performance, they tried to use this whole other platform because they were excited about having, you know, this new way of presenting it, and they got in a lot of trouble for it, you know?
Right.
And so that was canceled. They never did that again. So, you know, what Kitty was saying about a master text or a master performance, there is no such thing. So trying to find that holy grail is a little bit of a red herring. And so, you know, trying to sort of reinvent Shakespeare, as we're saying, is part of the very spirit of the enterprise from the beginning.
Interesting. I watched this documentary recently. It was called Shakespeare in Love. And is that fun for you guys? Do you sit there and go, oh, they're getting it wrong? No, it's not how it happened.
I quite enjoyed Shakespeare in Love. I did. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
I was going to say, I think, so, you know, I think there's a place for getting the scholarship right in terms of always sort of having the academy, you know, studying these things and making sure that, you know, we really are doing our best to understand the period and its complexity. But at the end of the day, you know, each generation needs to reinvent Shakespeare for themselves. They say, what do we want out of a Shakespeare? And how does that, you know, he gave us the spark, but what do we sort of do with that?
And if you can't
turn that into something, then again, it's this sort of hollow worship of the classics, which, you know, doesn't extend for more than a few generations.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Comedy Podcast. Send us your Shakespearean Valentines via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Comedy Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Shakespearean fool Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to David Foster. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Michael Whitmore, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., and thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 323 969th of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Fraud of man was ever so, since summer bird was never. And I not so, but let them go, and be you blind and money. Converting all your songs of woe into hymn, naughty, naughty. Converting all your songs of woe into hymn, naughty, naughty. Converting all your songs of woe into hymn, naughty, naughty.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.